one of the things that we quickly realized after kind of getting this project out there a little bit is that the community was going to be a critical part of this project. It wasn't just about the research. It was about empowering the community and trying to incorporate as much of the community into what we were doing. So this was like one of those win-win-win situations.
Bradford and Brian Manning are brothers, entrepreneurs, and business partners. They both have a degenerative retinal eye disease called Stargardt disease, where you lose your central vision over time. Welcome to the Safe Haven, a space for stories to be shared about the lights and darks, highs and lows of life. 5 years apart in age, both Brad and Brian started losing their central vision around 5 years old. Today, Brad and Brian explained that they really didn't know much different other than living with a visual impairment. In this episode, I sit down, virtually, of course, with Bradford and Brian Manning for a really great conversation about life with a visual impairment and the creation of their clothing business called Two Blind Brothers. We also talk about maintaining mental well-being, personal practices for best life balance, and why they're working so hard to create the softest, most comfortable clothing on the planet. I started by asking Bradford what Stargardt disease is.
So Stargardt's disease is a degenerative retinal eye disease where you lose your center vision over time. And a lot of people know like macular degeneration. A lot of grandparents or older folks develop that. Stargardt's is sort of a juvenile genetic version of that. And essentially what happens is it's a problem metabolizing vitamin A. So when your eyes metabolize vitamin A, if you have Stargardt, it leaves behind this byproduct, which is toxic to those cells. Mm. And so it kills those cells in the center vision. The reason it's center vision is because that metabolic process is just much more rapid and occurs much more in the central vision. And so what happens is practically is are things like recognizing faces, reading small print, driving become challenging or impossible. But peripheral vision, usually folks with Stargardt's do maintain a decent amount of their peripheral vision.
Mm-hmm. And being someone who, yes, I wear glasses and my eyesight would be considered terrible, I've never experienced anything like this. And with peripheral vision, I mean, how much peripheral vision do you have? And are you able to see colors? Are you able to see shapes? Or how does that impact it?
Yeah, great question. So we have a fair bit of peripheral vision to the point that if you saw me walking down the street or at a restaurant or bar, you probably wouldn't notice on a macro scale that there was any sort of vision issues. You know, I've had friends my life who are like, oh, yeah, I actually didn't know that for the first two or three times we met. Mm-hmm. However, when it turns into doing any sort of detail work, you know, reading a menu, reading a street sign, you know, bumping into something occasionally. You might just put that on being clumsy. I put it on having bad eyesight. Depends on who you ask. But a lot of it comes down to the center of our vision where there isn't, it's fascinating. There actually isn't a large hole as some would think. All the time. It's only when we put that blind spot onto a specific area does that area disappear. And as it relates to color, Brad and I do have color vision as well, you know, in shapes and sizes and all that. We can get a lot of it. You know, our color can be a little bit muted, but at the end of the day, it's what I've known my whole life. And this is why this question is so challenging is, you know, you were to describe your vision to somebody else, you'd have a hard time doing because the only way you've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And trying to describe something to somebody that's your own with no other frame of reference can be super challenging.
Yeah, no, I can understand that. And I have one experience personally with another person who has Stargardt's disease. He didn't get it until he was 16 years old and lost it in a matter of 2 weeks.
Wow, that's really rapid.
Hey everyone, just a quick post-recording edit in here for you to correct that the man that I'm referring to actually in fact has Leber's disease, or Leber hereditary optic neuropathy, where his optic nerve died very quickly, and yes, it was rapidly, in only a matter of a couple weeks, and now only has minimal peripheral vision. I just wanted to correct myself in that there. Okay, here we go, back in. He actually came to visit us a couple of years ago from Australia. And same thing as you mentioned about how for the first couple of times you might meet someone, you would have no idea. I had no idea that this guy was so visually impaired. I had no idea because he had developed strategies. And I think he was just in his early 20s when I'd met him and said, you know, this is the condition. This is what's up. This is what I'm moving forward with. And developed strategies to walk just a little bit behind the person in front of him, you know, and just kind of turn his head to the side so that he could see if things were in his way. But I would have never, ever known had I only just met him.
Yeah, it's, you know, one example I often use to give somebody context is if you've ever been to the optometrist and gotten your eyes dilated, you know, you still can see that there are the chairs there. But if you're a friend came up to you out of the blue and was like, hey, you'd be like, I can't tell who you are right now.
Okay, this is interesting. Thank you both for being with me. I'm so excited about this. So I want to fast forward a little bit because you two are really into a relatively new business here with two blind brothers. So if we fast forward into what this is, can I have the story of two blind brothers?
Sure. I'm the older brother, so naturally I always go first. No. Brian and I have always had this eye condition. We were always very close with each other. We're 5 years apart. And, you know, there's a lot of stories about us growing up and, you know, experiences with overcoming and handling, you know, the visual challenges. But we ended up both working in New York City. And one day we're walking around, and this is maybe about five years ago now. We were talking about a recent kind of medical breakthrough. There's a company called Spark Therapeutics that developed a gene therapy called Luxturna, which reverses blindness in a very rare eye condition called Leber's congenital amaurosis. It affects a gene called the RPE65 gene. But the bottom line is that they were starting clinical trials and they had tested it on this kid, this 12-year-old kid named Yannick Douay, who was blind reading Braille. And after receiving the gene therapy, he was reading print. And we'd always been very close to an organization called the Foundation Fighting Blindness, which has been working on this research for the past 40 years. And actually the Luxturna therapy, which is now curing blindness and you know, a few hundred children every year, started with a small charitable gift from the Foundation Fighting Blindness to a researcher that helped her identify the gene, which then later led to the therapy. So on this day, we happen to be shopping. And if you are blind or visually impaired, shopping can sometimes be a big pain in the ass. So you might go to the store and number one, Brian and I like lose each other everywhere we go. Usually I find him by his booming voice. And so when we're shopping, you know, to see the prices, the labels, the sizes, you know, the colors of the shirt, that can all be kind of a bit of a pain. So just the way that we've always done it is we'll just sort of grab something, realize if we figure out if we really just love the material, think it's good quality, feel the fit of it, and then do all the work to figure out if we want to buy it, if it's the right price, if it's the right size, if it's a men's shirt, made that mistake once. And on this fateful day, we leave the store and we had coincidentally bought this same exact shirt. And so we played rock, paper, scissors. I won. Brian had to go return the shirt. But when he came out from the store, we were talking about how that occurred. And just through that moment, a light bulb went off. Mm-hmm. So what if there's something to this? You know, people always talk about the idea that touch and feel is so important. It's something that we've focused on our entire lives. And even bigger than that, what if this could be our way to communicate the medical revolution that we are living through? The fact that we are reversing genetic diseases, the fact that it actually miracles in a certain way are being performed, and that having been so close to the Foundation Fighting Blindness, how do we translate the wonderful work that's being done into something people can hold and touch and feel. And that's only the idea that we would start a clothing brand with two simple missions. One, to make the best feeling and fitting shirts in the entire world that we possibly could. And two, to try to help fund research to cure blindness by donating all the profits from the project back to organizations like FFB. And that's when we came up with the brand Two Blind Brothers.
Mm-hmm. What were the full-time jobs that you had prior to this?
Yeah, I was working in data sales for a big technology company to banks and credit unions. And Brad was working at a small investment fund.
Okay.
So as you could imagine, 100% translatable skills to fashion brands. It was, you know, one to one matching.
Had you ever wanted to run your own business? Like, was this ever something that you'd kind of projected, you know, maybe one day, whether it was, I don't know if it was ever going to be clothing, but I mean, had you ever pictured yourselves as entrepreneurs?
Yeah. I mean, I know for Brad and myself, you know, we had a few things that were always interesting to us. You know, we both kind of have just a passion for learning about whatever we can and do it and learning by doing. You know, we've had, you know, as brothers after the teasing phase had ended, I think that was coincidentally the same time I got the same size as Brad. I don't know if that's weirdly correlated, but that's for a different podcast. But, you know, we always had this kind of desire to do fun projects, work on little things together, and just try and have a good time while getting as educated as we could. And I think this desire to be an entrepreneur was kind of in our hopes for the future to find, you know, some area where we think we could make the largest impact and go after it and make as many of the decisions as we could. I don't know if we ever intended to be business partners together because, mm-hmm. you know, tying yourself to your brother every day can be, I think, challenging is the most delicate word I can choose. But yeah, I think we always wanted to be entrepreneurs, but never would have guessed that it would have been fashion.
Mm-hmm. You know, people have a misconception about this project that it really was a deep entrepreneurial business aspiration. It really actually didn't start this way, and we try to communicate this in case it's helpful to somebody else. But it started from a really, really simple place. This was going to be a lot of fun for us, and we were also going to be helping a cause that we were very close to. It was not meant to be as big as it's become. We were doing it without regard for the scale of it. Nobody who is a real entrepreneur would want to prospectively go into the clothing brand business. It's about as competitive as like restaurants. I mean, that might be the one thing the fact is it was going to be a success in our minds from day one because we were going to have so much fun doing it. And so that's one of the big things that made this work for us is, you know, we weren't bogged down by the, how are we going to get enough sales of clothing when there's 10,000 brands out there and there's, you know, now we weren't focused on that. We were focused on the fact that we were going to do this regardless of the obstacles because we were just enjoying it.
Mm-hmm. Business startup though, and having participated in just the initial stages of a clothing business startup, even just earlier this year, which I have since pulled out of, it is flipping hard. It is so hard in my experience, just because like you've mentioned, there's so many different product types or material types. There's people that you could go to. Where are you going to have tags done? Where are you going to actually get these shirts made? All of these things, right? So I'm wondering how long it was that you were investing in this side give back opportunity before you really pulled back from your full-time jobs.
Yeah, it's a... So, I mean, starting any business, there are a million and a half problems. Mm-hmm. And then you make more mistakes than you think are legitimately possible to make. You feel like you very rarely make a right decision. Mm. But Brad and I had the great fortune of having some people around us, friends and acquaintances that had relationships in the industry that could help us. And that's one giant piece of advice I give to every aspiring entrepreneur is, there are people who know the answers to most of your questions, right? Your mm-hmm. secret sauce is still yours, but asking somebody, hey, where do you get your tags produced, saves you a tremendous amount of time to do research. And you're going to get a better product because they've already gone through the pain of solving this equation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like my now wife worked with us for a long time and had a lot of the industry side of that expertise of how to build, how, you know, what type of shirts should we be looking at? How are we actually going to do a lot of this work? And so we had a little bit of a leg up there. And so, but to your question of leaving the full-time work, we actually, as Brad said earlier, didn't ever burn the ships and say, we need to just jump into this, because over the course of 6 months, we had made a great brand video with a guy who was a Starbucks barista by day and videographer by night, mm-hmm. nothing too high budget, just Brad, myself, him and a camera telling our story. And we put it out on Facebook, and over the course of 6 months, it got just unfathomable traction. And we started doing local New York media and then online media like Now This, and we had done Fox 5. And then we actually had gotten a phone call from the Ellen DeGeneres show.
Yeah, this is where my mom was like, oh, I saw them on Ellen. I was like, wait, what?
So yeah, in 2017, early 2017, we were on the Ellen show. And so that just spiked our whole business tremendously. And then later that month, we were on NBC Nightly News with Lester Holt. Mm-hmm. And those two moments just catapulted our brand to a place where we then could feel comfortable to say, okay, we're at a large enough scale. Almost no brands get this much opportunity. We really should try and capitalize this and run this to the best of our ability to try and support this community as best as we can.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say earlier about values. The fact that you have matching values, I think, is so important here with the growth of the business, even with the startup idea, because you clearly, walking out of there with the same shirt, right? You clearly had the same ideas about comfort, but even with your life and with Stargardt disease, you have such a matching set of values as to how and why and where you would want to give back.
100%. I don't know if that was a question or not, but I'm happy to pontificate on that, because the truth of the matter is not a lot of people actually have talked to us about that before, but that is critical, especially when you're co-running a project with somebody. Oftentimes at the beginning of the project, it's easy to get on the same page. You know, it's like anything. It's like a marriage. It's like a relationship. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to get on the same page. But then when, you know, the tough questions come up, that's when those values are really challenged. And, you know, Brian and I joke, though, that, you know, we do have experience of 30 years of fighting with each other. And so we are really good at fighting. So that's helped us get through those tough moments, probably more mm-hmm. than most typical business partners.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that I had actually pulled back, it was because when I sit down, for example, when I sit down to record or edit for this podcast, I just want to do that all the time. Having these kinds of conversations and connecting with people around the world, like that ignites my soul. And so I really had to check my ego and digest, Amanda, why are you so interested in this business? Because you're not. Like, why are you trying to be? And so I really had to be able to say to them, I love you guys. I trust you. Please continue running without me, because I think that my lack of passion for this will pull you down. And one of my business partners was talking about, if a team gets together and has an extreme level of passion and matched value, but no know-how, they are going to be far more successful than the same crew that would get together with zero passion, but all the know-how. And that's when I was kind of like, that's the cherry on top for me. That's when I had to really pull back and say, you know what? I love you guys, but this is just not my journey.
It's a really good point. It's good recognition on your side for a lot of that, because it's really easy to get bogged down in a lot, because there are just a million things to get done whenever you're starting a business or working at any job. And a lot of that passion and that enthusiasm changes it from being mundane work of trying to find, hey, where are we going to get labels from, to, hey, how do we make the best goddamn labels on the planet? And I'm so excited because we're going to do a super cool XYZ with this label. And that's going to be a really fun part of the whole project. And it moves from complaining or arguing with a fulfillment center to, oh, we're actually trying to solve a solution so we can get people packages more. And that being able to shift that paradigm or shift that perspective when you're looking at it through a lens of passion and joy makes all of that stuff so much easier. And so you really do, at some level, have to love what you're doing or love what the outcome will be so much that it allows you to force through any of those early and often problems.
That is a really beautiful segue into tactical identifiers, because this is so beautiful. And I would love for one of you to tell us about that.
We got really, this was a lot of fun for us. It comes from sort of a deep experience that Brian and I had growing up, because when we were, I was probably in early high school, Brian was in middle school, and our mom came to us after having met with some, we call them our vision teachers. These are sort of, you know, state provided teachers that help the visually impaired community with orientation and mobility and skills and stuff like that. And, you know, our mom was always like very skeptical, you know, of, you know, having us not participate in sort of whatever you would call sort of a mainstream sort of academic experience. But she came to us and said, you know, I think you guys ought to take some classes with these teachers and learn to read Braille. And on the back end, we didn't know this, but what our mom, you know, was worried about is she didn't know how much vision we were going to lose and how quickly. You know, Brian and I still have the ability to read very large print. But at that time, our mom was trying to make sure that we were prepared with the skills that we needed to be successful. The way that she pitched it to us was like, oh, this is going to be so cool. Like, imagine giving a speech and not having to like look down at the page. You can just read it with your hand. You're going to be like, so, you know, it's going to be a little superpower for you. And so we basically started getting, we were taken out of school once or twice a week and brought to learn to read Braille. And we had a lot of moments like this, these moments where you feel that you're, you know, being treated in sort of a unique way. Maybe it makes you feel isolated. Maybe it makes you feel different, but in a weird way, it was a bonding experience for Brian and I, because now we became competitive over who could learn Braille the fastest. And we would kind of have fun with learning it. And then when it got time to think about sort of how, you know, the branding of the clothing, we thought, oh my God, what an incredible thing that we can take what is kind of a you know, a tool in the blind and visually impaired community, also sort of a cultural icon. Even if you don't know how to read Braille, you know what it means, you know what it stands for. And what if instead of it being isolating or making us feel different in a way that could be perceived as bad, you know, what if we made this the centerpiece of our branding and actually showed how cool it was? Because one of the big issues in the blind community is Braille literacy. There just isn't a lot of adoption, and a lot of kids and children are resistant to sort of learning it. And so it's become a major part of our brand, not only graphically and aesthetically, but as you were maybe alluding to, it has a utility. So on the hem of all of our shirts, we'll put the color of the shirt in Braille that you can feel. So we kind of think of it as a way that we logo our clothing. But if you are blind or visually impaired and you're trying to figure out what color you're wearing, which is sort of the big complaint for a lot of folks who can't see well because they're trying to match their outfits, they'll know what color they're wearing when they go into their closet. And so that's been an awesome, fun aspect of the brand for us.
I think that's really incredible. You guys talk a lot about the softness of your garments. Can you talk a bit about why soft?
Oh, why are they soft? I'll go into exquisite detail for you. So a little experiment, at home experiment here, is if you take your hand and you run it on the table in front of you, it feels incredibly smooth until you hit a high or low point, or in my case, a crumb from the sandwich I had for lunch. It was a BLT. It was delicious. I need to clean my desk. But until you hit that crumb or that high point, you actually feel it feels incredibly smooth. And that sense of friction is the same concept into what makes things soft. So we use a tri-blend fabric. It's 66% bamboo. And bamboo is these incredibly long cylindrical fibers. So that tie point is far apart, moving those friction points as far apart from one another as you can. But the problem with bamboo is it is very drapey. It kind of just falls. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we use a 26% long spun cotton. Again, longer tie points, but shorter than bamboo, but the cotton is such a strong and structured fabric. So what that does is it keeps the shirt looking like a shirt from the first time that you wear it to the 100th time you wear it. And then we use 8% spandex or Lycra. And the reason being is that if you ever put on a Two Blind Brothers shirt, you can move in it and it moves with you and it stretches with you. And so it feels more like a second skin than it does a shirt. So those, that kind of cross section of those three things creates softness, structure, and elasticity. And we think it's probably the best blend of fabrics you could possibly have in clothing.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you talk about the feeling of a fabric or just wearing things based on how soft they are, how comfortable they are. Or in my case, if it's like a stretchy pair of tights, I'm all over it because I feel like I can do anything in these, right? So the feeling or the touch of things, absolutely. And I think just in society, right, you just expect people to be in these really well put together outfits, right, or matching attire. But if I was to just go through my wardrobe and put on the comfiest shirt and the comfiest pair of pants and the comfiest pair of socks, it probably would not go together well. So I think that this is a really cool concept to dive into a clothing line that is strictly based on comfort and softness.
And we put a lot of diligence. We put as much diligence as we can into the actual cut of the shirt as well, so that it doesn't have that sensation of, oh, I'm walking out of my pajamas. You know, the Henley is just such a beautiful and versatile shirt that it can be dressed up a little more formally, or you could just wear it around, lounging around your house. And so this idea of what usually makes an outfit or a garment of clothing seem more, let's call it, beautiful on the body is actually the cut of the garment. And so we spend a lot of time with fit models and with a lot of different body types to try and get a cut that was both comfortable as well as flattering on, you know, different people in different shapes.
Mm-hmm. I love the effort and the love that goes into this. It's a really beautiful project. And I'd love it if one of you could tell me about shopping blind. You have a campaign on right now about shopping blind. Tell me about that.
So this was an experiment that is now sort of taken over our project in a certain regard. A few years ago, we had this idea because we always talk about how one of the greatest tools or resources that Brian and I ever had growing up to kind of deal with life's little challenges was the trust we would place in other people. So, you know, if we can't see something, you know, we can have a magnifier or we can take our iPhone and take a photo of it. There's all kinds of things you can do. But one of the easiest things that we found is just asking the person standing next to us, hey, do you know how to get to such and such place? Or what is the number of that building? Or, you know, I can't see the menu. What do you recommend? You know, what do you recommend I eat? And these little acts of trust lift us up. 99.9% of the time, it just makes life easier. And it makes the person who's helping you actually feel good too. People mm-hmm. think that when you ask for a favor, you're taking something. You're actually giving them something in a way. I mean, people feel needed. They feel purposeful. It's something that we've talked about. And so we thought, well, how can we create this online, especially the shopping experience when we can't always see what we're getting, but we might trust somebody to tell us if it looks good or we should get it. And so we ended up kind of blacking out the whole website. No products, no images, no descriptions, just a price point and a question. Will you shop blind based on trust? And what inevitably happened is people really were compelled by it. In a way, it was almost an insult to all the graphic design and e-commerce best in practice, you know, best in class stuff we tried to do, where all of a sudden we remove everything and people actually responded even more strongly. So that's sort of the main experience. If you go to twoblindbrothers.com, that's what you'll initially see, the shop blind experience. And it's been awesome. It's been a lot of fun. One of the things that we've been lucky to have happen is people will like do unboxings of it. It's sort of a, you know, it's in a sense, it's sort of a mystery box. And it's actually changed the kind of trajectory of what we're doing. People have just responded super well to it.
So how does it work for sizing or for colors? Or do you literally just put in a size and just go for it?
I was going to say, well, if we told you, it would ruin the mystery. Come on.
Like, this is true.
Just talks about it was all about trust. And your first question.
I know. I'm so bad at this.
You know, the truth is that, so if we are going to send you something that relates to your specific size, we will have a sort of a little selector that says, you know, who are you shopping for and what size, mm-hmm. what's their size. And, but oftentimes there's a lot of very giftable non-sized size dependent items that we can also put in that experience. So it really is a complete mystery.
I think it's super cool. Super, super cool. I wanted to come back to a question about the diagnosis of that, because I recognize that you guys are 5 years apart. So Brad, were you diagnosed around 5 years old and then Brian, same thing, or was it roughly 5 years old for both of you?
So when I was, so when I was 5 years old, I failed the kindergarten eye chart, which started this 2-year hunt to figure out, you know, what had happened to my eyesight. And after a lot of doctors, I end up in this office with my mom. They do this test where they actually dye your blood and then they can see the scar tissue on your retina. And that's when they were able to confirm that I had Stargardt's disease. Now it's easier because there's a genetic test. And then that was sort of 2 years later. And then obviously when Brian had, you know, symptoms around the same age, it was easier to diagnose.
Is it something that will get worse or has become progressively worse with age?
Yeah. So the way Stargardt's works typically, and again, you know, we can speak for our case and for what we've seen in a lot of cases, but like any disease, there's definitely tails on either side. But what usually happens is your vision gets aggressively worse for the first few years and then gets steadily worse for about a total of 10 years. And after that, in most cases, your vision plateaus and at kind of that negative position, you know, where it was. Brad and I's vision went from 20/20 to, I think we're right now at 2400. And for some context, 20/20 means you can read 20-point font at 20 feet away. 2400 means you can read 400-point font from 20 feet away.
Wow. That's such a difference. To be honest, even though I've worn glasses, a very strong prescription since I was in grade 4, I've never really understood exactly what they're doing when they're trying to figure out my eyesight. I guess I just don't know enough about it. So that's really interesting. So 2400, you said.
Yeah, 2400. And interestingly, we get this question quite often is, you know, why don't you just wear glasses? Like, why do glasses not help? And the best analogy that I've come up with is, you know, if you think about a camera, you could have the best lens in the world, and that's what your glasses are. But if you have bad film, you're going to get bad pictures regardless.
Mm-hmm.
And so all glasses would do for us is just change the lens, which is usually fine. It's the film that's the problem.
Right, because it's essentially it's right in the center of your vision.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So having listened to a podcast that you guys were on previously, I would love to know why and how the transition for manufacturing came around to the Dallas Lighthouse for the Blind. How did that come about?
So when Brian and I got all this fortunate publicity at the beginning of 2017, you know, we started hearing from all different kinds of folks in the community. But one of those people was a guy named Greg, who was the CFO of the Dallas Lighthouse for the Blind. And it was one of those calls that you just couldn't, we were totally unaware of these organizations that are 70% or more visually impaired or blind staffed. A lot of them do a lot of government contract work, uniforms, you know, folders, pens, just all kinds of, you know, mass products that the government may need. And so Greg told us that that Dallas Lighthouse would be able to do our production for our garments. And we couldn't believe it, because one of the things that we quickly realized after kind of getting this project out there a little bit is that the community was going to be a critical part of this project. It wasn't just about the research. It was about empowering the community and trying to incorporate as much of the community into what we were doing. So this was like one of those win-win-win situations. And so since then, actually, Dallas Lighthouse ended up actually getting sort of acquired or merging with a similar organization called Envision, which actually no longer does the types of clothing manufacturing. But we work with, there's a lot of other partners that do similar stuff in the space. So right now, for example, we work with an organization called Industries for the Blind in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And yeah, it's been a really, really cool part of our project.
I think that's really beautiful. I didn't realize that the employment there was 70% people that have a visual impairment.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's absolutely, we've been there several times. It's remarkable.
Mm-hmm. It's really beautiful. Yeah. So I have some safe haven style questions for you. And if we could start with Bradford, if life is going sideways and you're feeling really stressed out about things, what are some personal practices that you have to maintain balance or wellness?
A couple things. So we all have those things that kind of help us decompress. And obviously those are specific to individuals. But for me, it's working out, having a great meal, watching The Office, playing on chess.com, or hanging out with my wife, Roxanne, and going on like a long walk in the city. Those things really, really help me. I think another huge thing is actually understanding some of the psychology around stress. So understanding that if you can get out of your ruminating mind so that you're just focused on the present, you're enjoying life in front of you as it is really powerful. And then also understanding the consequence of the stress that you're going through, and the fact that every challenge, despite how much it might suck in the moment, has this funny thing of making you call forth your greater internal resources, and you inevitably become stronger, more creative, more resilient, more resourceful because of that uncomfortable moment.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree with that. Doing that deep dive inwards just to really analyze and evaluate yourself and what's going on, what's going wrong, what's going right. Yeah, great answer. I actually have a part B in that before we switch over to Brian here. A common misconception, I guess, is that people with a visual impairment would have a really difficult time watching TV. In your experience with TV, are you able to, obviously, the storyline, and because you can still hear, you're able to hear the storyline and what's going on? Are you able to follow along and see what's going on as well?
So I watch almost all of my quote TV basically on my laptop, probably closer to my face than you know, than any parent would want their kid ever watching, because they think that their eyes are going to get stuck cross-eyed or something. if it's large enough and in my face, you know, I can follow pretty well. There are some like kind of cool things. There's things called audio descriptions, which are specifically made for folks who are blind or visually impaired. So you're not only getting the dialogue of the episode or the movie, but you're getting a description of sort of what's on screen. We don't use those too much, but I would say that I don't watch, for example, things that are subtitled, because reading the subtitles or having somebody read them to me is just more work than it's worth. Watching The Office on my laptop is very, very doable.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Brian, we're going to switch the question over for you about balance in your life.
Yeah. So I have a few things I adore. Running. I feel like that de-stresses me tremendously. Cooking is another area that I mm-hmm. adore. Hanging with my wife, Court, always puts a big smile on my face. And I just really like to be around people. I like to be, which has been a little challenging nowadays because I'm not supposed to be. I really like being with friends, with family, just as spending as much time around folks as I can. I really, really enjoy that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So now this time we're going to go, Brian, you're going to go again, but for the second question, which is, what are you most proud of?
What am I most proud of? Woof.
Mm-hmm.
Is not killing Brad something to be proud, like not committing suicide? I feel like I'm pretty proud of that. No, I mean, you know, I got married in May, so I'm finding a woman that I'm going to spend the rest of my life with and make it and convincing her to fall in love with me is I'm incredibly proud of that from a personal perspective. And from a professional perspective, you know, two blind brothers, we get messages probably every couple days, every day, from families that were recently diagnosed with retinal eye diseases. And it can be, and usually is, one of the hardest times in a person's life. Mm. And we get to be a resource for those families who have no idea where to turn to. So just start Googling like we all do. And because of the media, we pop up and we'll try and take as much time as we can every single week to talk to these families, just to, with no prescriptive advice, just to have a conversation and try and make their world spin a little bit slower. And being able to go back in time, and because of running this project for 4 years, we've stayed in touch with some of these people, and getting to see the development of that, you know, that child or that adult or whoever, and having them say that we were really helpful during that time. You know, you can look at any business metrics and be proud of them, but being able to help somebody when they're at their lowest is probably the area where I'm most proud of the business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's beautiful. And Bradford, what about you?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'll have an uncreative answer and have to agree with Brian. You know, if I'm really forced to answer that, I think the answer really is the success of the Two Blind Brothers Project as measured by the community reaction. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Brian and I get to go back in time in a way and give what was the most helpful advice or lessons learned for us to those people as they're experiencing what is a hard moment for them is probably what I'm the most proud of.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Brad, you get to go first for this one. What would you like to be known for?
You know, I'm a big believer in trying to get yourself focused on a process-oriented approach. So I don't believe that you ever sort of achieve a specific result, you reach a specific end, and that achievement kind of represents your legacy. So I guess what I would say is, you know, if I can be known for working hard, working passionately, treating the people who are closest to me really well, that's probably what I'd want to achieve.
Mm-hmm. And Brian, what about you? What would you like to be known for?
What would I like to be known for? First blind guy in space. if that's on the table, I'd be pretty happy with that one. I think the view would be lost on me, but I'd be happy to go up just to check it out. I'd say what I would like to be known for. You know, it's a challenging question because it changes fairly regularly. You know, we early on in your life, you want to just be known as a good, you know, I just have somebody trying to buzz into the apartment real fast. It's okay. In the middle of my profound and dramatic answer. Because it changes so often, it's a hard question. You know, I would say at the start of Two Blind Brothers, I really wanted to be known as a great entrepreneur. Before that, I wanted to just be known as a great employee and a great friend. And, you know, as we go forward from here, you know, I would love to be known as the blind guy who's helped a lot of people, or just a person who's helped a lot of people. I don't need the first moniker, but at the end of the day, I think the most important thing to be known for is to be known as a person who always shows up for their friends, always shows up for the people that cares about them, and is a person of their word, you know? And I think that if you can do those three things, be known as those three things, you've lived a pretty successful life up to that point.
Mm-hmm. You guys are good at this. Okay, yeah. Brian. Okay, I've got another one for you here. If you had a message for everyone listening, what would it be?
Yeah, I think that one piece of advice that's been really important to me is that the worst anyone can ever do to you is say no. This is especially true for entrepreneurs or people who are struggling to put themselves out there or do whatever you can. You know, I got this piece of advice when I was probably 15 or 16, but the worst somebody can do is say no. If you need help, you can ask for help. If you have a question about business, you can reach out to that person that you aspire to be and ask them, hey, can you help me? As long as you're polite and thoughtful. You know, the worst that happens is the person says no and you end up in the exact same spot that you were before. And as long as you're being polite and as long as you're being thoughtful, there's really almost no downside for you. And so sometimes we all get in our own heads to say, oh, I can't, I don't know. They don't want to hear from me. This is going to be a huge problem. I'm, you know, and you think about what you're going to write, how you're going to say it, everything except for actually doing it. Mm-hmm. And I think that you often forget that the worst outcome is the person goes, no, thanks. And then you just go on with the day.
Yeah. And Brad, what about you?
I think probably the best advice that I've ever received and that, you know, we try to promote is to embrace being uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we've come to appreciate is that people are at different stages in their journey, especially when we talk to families or individuals that have an eye condition. And what I think is really unique about the spirit of your podcast is it really reflects sort of step one, which is that, you know, you need a place and a time to reflect, to contemplate, to digest, to interpret, to set intention. And then there's another step, which is to embrace that being uncomfortable. And really that, for me at least, boils down to the fact that it's very hard to grow without friction. And so when we were having our struggles with vision issues growing up, we learned things like assertiveness, creativity, resourcefulness from being put into situations where we wouldn't have actually been able to succeed or mitigate failure without calling on those skills. And I think the worst thing that can happen for somebody who gets hit with a particular unique challenge is that they then ascribe a psychological or some other impairment to themselves. I am not as good at XYZ, therefore I can't compete as well. Or I'm not as good at XYZ, so I can't be successful in the same way that other people can. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't seed that ground. You cannot seed that ground because that actually produces a psychological impairment where maybe you had, you know, a physical one that could have been overcome with the right mentality, the right resources, the right technology. So embracing being uncomfortable, understanding that it's those moments of uncomfort that will yield your greatest personal gifts is what we try to promote.
Thank you both for your answers there. I've got one more to wrap up the day. Where and how can society do better for the visually impaired?
Sure, I can jump in there. You know, there's an incredible video that I watched recently. A girl named Claire, in a documentary on YouTube. I think her name is Claire. I think the name of it is Claire. And she had cystic fibrosis. She's passed away since. And she has she gives a speech at one point. She's a very dynamic young woman. And she gives a speech where she talks about how, you know, she's been sick, quote unquote, sick since the day she was born with cystic fibrosis. And one of the toughest things for her was not all the treatments she had, but it was actually when friends of friends or friends of her parents would come into her hospital room and take on that look of pity, get sad and say to her, "Oh, it must be so tough and I'm so sorry to see you in this situation." And she has a quote in a speech where she says, "When you pity somebody, you disempower them." And there really is something there, because you don't want to project a victim mentality onto people. There is a time and a place for recognizing an injustice and taking active steps to resolve it, but also make sure that you are not projecting a victim mentality onto somebody. And so, you know, we certainly see that with, you know, folks with the blind community. We think one of the big solutions for it is exposure. Think of whatever disability or unique community or, you know, underrepresented person you can. A lot of the issues that they face are because that it's a familiarity and an exposure issue. If you truly know that person or know their experience, then a lot of the problems actually end up solving themselves. Mm-hmm. And so we think that through exposure and getting out there, and technology's been helping this a lot, that is one of the big ways that we can move forward on that.
Mm-hmm. And Brian, did you have anything to add there?
I thought he did a really good job on that one.
Yeah, agreed.
I rarely do, but well said.
Well, to both of you, I am so grateful for your time. I appreciate you both, everything that you're doing. And I would love to make sure that my listeners can find you on social media and online.
Yeah, you can check us out at 2TWO Blind, BLIND Brothers. com. And if you want on social or anywhere else, we're also just 2 Blind Brothers, all spelled out. So if you want to come shop blind, if you want to come feel the softest clothing in the world, or you want to just see what our smiling faces look like, come and come to 2 Blind Brothers and investigate a little bit.
Amazing. I will have those linked at the bottom of the podcast as well, so that the notes are there and people can just click them. Easy link.
Great.
Yeah. Guys, thank you so, so much.
It was absolutely our pleasure.
No.
It was an awesome, awesome time. And, you know, Brad and I are always so grateful to do these, because, you know, we would not be where we are without people taking a chance on having us for an interview, getting our message out, and being able to connect with as many folks as we possibly can. So we really appreciate you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for what you're doing. You know, the principles that you're building your podcast on are the ones that, you know, we're trying to promote as well. And so we really appreciate it. And looking forward to connecting again soon.
Mm-hmm. I'll be sure to send all of the links as well as it comes out, so that you guys can have a listen.
Great. Can't wait.
What a great conversation. Thank you both for sharing your time and your stories and perspectives on the Safe Haven with me and our listeners. I love your ideas and your goals, and I wish you the greatest success. To everyone listening, I recognize the privilege that comes with my platform, and I am committed to creating a safe, brave, and inclusive space with intention. If this episode has hit you right in the heart or inspired you in any way, please screenshot the screen while you're listening, send it to your friends, and share it in your Instagram stories.
And please be sure to tag us so that we can personally thank you for it. If you're able to write a review or leave a juicy 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, even better. Come find us on Instagram at The Safe Haven Podcast. For more great podcasts, check out frequencypodcastnetwork.com, and I will talk to you next week.